decision is based on a military decision. It's not meant to be anything more than that, and it's simply about, obviously, it's a very difficult decision. It's not a simple one, but the president feels that it's the best one for the military.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders explaining President Trump's tweet that transgender people would no longer be allowed to serve in the U.S. military. The White House was not able to answer any questions about how or when transgender troops would have to leave. It's estimated that there are thousands of such troops, perhaps 11,000, currently serving in the military, including active duty, National Guard, and reserves. The numbers are unclear because transgender troops have only been allowed to serve openly for a year. Abby Phillip of the Washington Post joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. So apparently there were some questions asked at this news conference about what exactly President Trump meant with these tweets. Any clarity?
No, not particularly. I think the line from the White House is that they will figure it out along with the Pentagon, but it just speaks to the degree to which this was not a decision that was essentially ready for prime time. I mean, many people in the administration and advisors to the president expect him to move in this direction, but the timing is really what is unusual about this. And as a result, there are really no plans to implement this guidance. The Pentagon hasn't had a chance to really work out what it will mean for the people, as you mentioned. It could be up to 11,000 people who are currently serving in the military right now who are transgender and have been brought out of the shadows for some period of time and would need to be dealt with in one way or another.
So even though the president tweeted that he consulted with members of the military, leaders in the military about this, it seems today that the Pentagon did not have any answers to questions about this whole thing?
It's been an ongoing conversation in this White House for a very long time. So the president has been discussing this with his military advisors, the Department of Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. But at the same time, there was not necessarily an indication that they were ready to roll out a final decision or that they had had an opportunity to work out what the details of that decision would be. And as the White House noted today, they have to make sure that whatever they do passes legal muster. I think a lot of people expect that going forward, because of the scope of what Trump seemed to announce on Twitter today, they will almost certainly be dealing with legal challenges to this decision as people challenge it on the basis that it's blatantly discriminatory.
Mm. What about the ongoing discussions, though, that have been going on in the House amongst the Republicans in terms of the budget process when it comes to funding gender reassignment surgery in the military? That's been going on as a backdrop to this, correct?
It has, and it's been one of those issues where there have been a lot of several social conservatives in the House who have pushed back on this, who have wanted to prohibit the Pentagon from using federal money to do these gender reassignment surgeries. But interestingly, GOP leadership and moderate Republicans have pushed back. As a result, this amendment that they were going to attach to another bill failed because Democrats and moderate conservatives voted it down. So this was the idea of blocking gender reassignment surgery in the military didn't even have enough support, really, to pass in a Republican Congress. But at the same time, it's very important to certain conservatives who also have the ear of the White House.
And would that have endangered the president's other priorities, such as earmarking money to build a wall?
Potentially. And we know that this, the wall being a top priority for Trump, he's very inclined to do what it takes to get that done quickly. I mean, I think most people expected Trump to in some way pare back the transgender in the military guidance from the Obama administration. The question is of degree and also a question of timing. And so the fact that these things are coinciding certainly suggests that Trump was moved to act more quickly because he wanted to get this issue off the table so it can clear the way for the wall and frankly for other things on the Hill.
Abby Phillip of The Washington Post, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Sage Fox. She was the first transgender person to be allowed to serve openly in the military some 4 years ago. She's been on two deployments and has served 14 years. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your reaction to today's news?
Well, the first thing I heard about it was pretty devastating, and now I'm kind of furious. But the analytical aspect of me looks at it and goes, as she said, is this a lawful order? Will this go through and stand up? As military leaders, we have to look at everything we're given, every order we're given, and question that. Is this a lawful order? And, you know, there's a moral obligation to deny and refuse to obey unlawful orders, but also a legal obligation as well. We can be held liable for going through and taking action on something that we know is not a right thing to do or know we won't stand muster. I mean, if someone tells you to shoot a prisoner, that's against the Geneva Convention. You can't do those things. And if you do that, you're not only liable for, you know, the person who gave you the order, but you yourself as an individual. So if, you know, Secretary of Defense, you know, gets up there or any of these military leaders and starts to follow this without it passing legal muster, they can be held liable as well.
So would you file a lawsuit?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, any civil rights leader, not just the trans rights organizations, but any civil rights leader should be standing up and taking notice of this and preparing legal lawsuits against this. Because this may be looking at a trans issue, but this is, in my opinion, a civil rights issue. If he can go through and set civil rights policy with a tweet, right, what does that say for the rest of the country? What does that say for everybody else's rights?
Now, what about this idea that the House Republicans, as Abby Phillip was just mentioning, are we're talking about not allowing the military to spend money, not earmarking money for gender reassignment surgery or any other related health costs?
Well, as you said, that bill was shot down, thankfully. But again, most of the arguments against that are based upon false information. They inflate the numbers into the billions. It's ridiculous. It's in the low millions. It's like, you know, $2 to $8 million they expect for health care, not just for surgery, but for health care for trans individuals on an annual basis. This is in a $40 billion budget, you know, for the military as a whole, for medical care for the military. So again, it's a drop in the bucket. We probably spend more on birth control and diabetes treatments than we do on trans health care. So it's a very marginal thing, but it's an argument they try to spin again and again. The same arguments they're used before for an LGBT service members. They've used the same kind of arguments before for, you know, integrated women into service and into combat arms, and before that, racial integration. They go through and perpetuate all these myths and all these stereotypes and this misunderstanding and fan the flames of this fear and this ignorance.
Right. And so they're also talking about military cohesion and morale again today. And just in your experience, what has that been like as you have come out as transgender?
Well, when I came out, I came out in a unit where I'd been with them for about 6 years, just come back from military deployment to the Middle East. And yeah, they were shocked. But I had people coming up to me afterwards and saying, ma'am, I had no idea you were so masculine. I had no clue this is who you were. But you know what? You were a great leader. You're a great officer and you're a great soldier. And I'm happy to serve with you in any capacity. So welcome aboard. And again, I had no kickback. I had no problems with it. I was treated with respect. This is what people understand. We're professionals. If you put the uniform on and you go through service and you go through all this training, you are a professional and you trust the person next to you and you care much more about their ability to do their job than about what's in their pants or who they love.
Sage Fox, military veteran and LGBT activist, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think the president should end the policy? Do you favor it? Do you think it's wrong what he did today on Twitter and what he announced today on Twitter? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Okay, maybe you've seen this, a video of a man overturning a street vendor's cart here in Los Angeles. It went viral.
What are you doing?
Don't you
try it.
Stay the
way. Me vale madre. De aquí no me voy a quitar. No me voy a quitar.
Okay, that's a sign, the sound of a guy in El Otero. He sells corn on a street in Hollywood. He recorded the video with his cell phone. They're shouting. It looks like some chili powder is thrown. The vendor says the man threatens him with a taser. Corn, containers, condiments are everywhere. The confrontation settles down as the vendor continues to narrate the video, but the incident raises questions about the safety of the estimated 50,000 vendors selling food and trinkets on the streets of L.A. Azucena Favela is Programs and Operations Director at the Leadership for Urban Renewal Network. It advocates on behalf of street vendors. Hello there.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, this vendor in the video is a man named Benjamin Ramirez. His dad is a well-known street vendor. You've been in touch with the family. What have they told you about this incident?
So this happened last Monday, and so it's been a week since they decided to release the video late Sunday evening at the encouragement of their daughter, who really felt like sharing the video with folks would raise awareness of what's happening in the streets with street vendors. And so since then, the outpour of support has really helped Ben Hamin, as he says in his own words, to really feel comfortable to come back out. He had already decided he wasn't going to vend anymore because he really felt threatened by this individual.
So he has had previous encounters with this guy.
He shared he'd had at least four, and they had all been verbal. Until this point, it became physical, which is why his dad had already instructed him to record him if he was harassed again.
And so how is he going to pay for the destruction of his cart?
So, you know, they're resilient. They went back home that evening, looked at the damage, and actually Alex, his dad, started repairing the cart, and they were able to replace some of their belongings. We created a fund maybe 2 to 3 weeks ago when Andres, a well-known also elotero in Highland Park, had his equipment confiscated by the health department and LAPD. And the purpose of the fund was really, as we thought about how often this happens, to really create support for street vendors to recoup their belongings as soon as possible, because we know this is their livelihood. So part of the funds that we've raised will definitely go to the family to recoup some of the equipment, but also, you know, to fill in for some of the loss in wages.
Now, the LA City Council has moved to decriminalize street vending. Is it now legal in Los Angeles?
So that's a common misconception, and I keep hearing this from folks. Well, it's legal now. It's legal. And unfortunately, it is still illegal to vend on sidewalks. What the City Council did do in February was remove a misdemeanor charge. And that was really prompted by the election of the president, who threatened to deport anyone with any convictable crimes. So street vending is technically a crime. And so that's part of the work that they did in February, where they did task the chief legislative analyst to develop a proposal for a permit system that's now being created, should be released in August, that then will be heard by the Economic Development Committee, and then by Public Works, and then again by the City Council. So it's still a lengthy process that we hope will be expedited by examples like this.
Okay, so I'm still a little confused. If they remove the misdemeanor charge, how is it illegal? What could they be charged with, and why would they be arrested if there's no misdemeanor associated with it?
So they removed it from one code, and there's still two other codes under which it actually could still be a misdemeanor charge. The challenge here is that it's not enforced uniformly. It's not equal across the board. So it really depends on how the citation is written, the judge you have to appear before, whether equipment was confiscated. So it's a really complex process. But it was only removed under one code. There's still parks, for example, where folks could be charged, and there's another code under peddling under which folks could be charged. And so the misdemeanor removes the charge itself. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you're protected from citations, and it doesn't mean that you're protected from your equipment being confiscated by the health department and the LAPD.
And as you say, many of these vendors are undocumented, and so they feel especially vulnerable.
Absolutely. And I think this is a great incident in which we can see someone that allegedly recently moved into this community and just decided that he is not supportive of street vendors in the community, and has made it very clear to this vendor and others that he does not want to see, you know, he doesn't want to see the tamales, he doesn't want to see the elotes, or, you know, the shaved ice, the raspados.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for talking about the issue.
That's Azucena Favela from the Leadership for Urban Renewal Network. And we want to hear from you. Is there a street vendor operating on your street or nearby? What do you think of their presence? Do you welcome them, or does it bother you? You can comment on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how Oakland is trying to turn the drug war on its head. That's coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to Oakland now, where the city is making progress on a program designed to turn the drug war on its head. It helps people with marijuana convictions, including ex-felons and some others, to get into the pot business for themselves. Oakland City Council member Rebecca Kaplan is one of the drivers of this effort, and she's with us. Hi.
Hello there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Well, let's begin at the beginning. Can you lay out how this program works?
Yes, absolutely. So Oakland was the first city to create permits for medical cannabis dispensaries, and that was over a decade ago. It's been very successful. Now what we're doing this year is we're adding permits for growers, edibles manufacturers, and other stages in the system. And as we do that, we added to our permit program an equity system, which seeks to set aside half of the permits for those who've historically been marginalized by the war on drugs, so that as new economic opportunities come forward, that those who were historically harmed by the war on drugs aren't left out of the chance now that it's becoming legal.
So how do you prove that you were harmed by the war on drugs and you deserve to have an application for a dispensary?
So Oakland's system has two methods. One is people who specifically have been arrested or prosecuted for a marijuana offense. And the other thing we're doing is targeting neighborhoods that have suffered the most. So residents of designated neighborhoods. So those two categories are given particular support through the set aside of half the permits.
Okay. And this began in March, correct?
Correct.
And I understand you have a progress report.
Yes, you know, I'm very pleased to see that we are getting significant number of equity applicants. And when the program was initially proposed, originally by Councilmember Desley Brooks, what many of the people who opposed it said is, well, nobody who meets these criteria is going to apply and it's not going to work. And so what both Councilmember Brooks and myself and others and our Department of Race and Equity pointed out is that the reason people might not apply is because they would have trouble finding a building, finding space to operate out of if people didn't have a lot of money. So we created an incentive to encourage applicants who have more money, typically the non-equity applicants, to set aside a portion of their space to enable startups of people who don't have money to buy a building. And we've seen great success. We have a significant number of equity applicants and a significant number of non-equity applicants offering incubator space.
Is there a danger, and I don't know if you've addressed this or not, or come up with some way to try to prevent this, that there will be non-equity applicants who put forward an equity applicant as the face of their business? And, you know, they're not really part of the business, but they're put forward to make sure that they get the permit.
Well, luckily, this system is staffed, and people who apply have to go through an entire review and have their information put forward, and the permits have to be annually renewed, so each year you have to show that you're meeting the requirements. So even if somebody tried to do it, they wouldn't get away with it for very long.
All right. So in the grander scheme of things, if you could just put this into context and describe for us why this is so important for the city of Oakland that you have this program.
The history of the war on marijuana has really been primarily a history of a war on black people. And activities that most white people don't really consider crimes and don't think their, you know, 20-something kids should go to jail for was created as a way to lock up black people by the millions for behavior that most white people don't really consider criminal. And so you've ended up with a situation in which people had their lives derailed, had their job opportunities derailed, had in many cases their freedom taken away. And now that the United States is, as a whole, admitting that marijuana shouldn't really be treated as a crime, it's important that we don't leave those who've suffered from this historically to continue to be left behind.
Have you heard at all from the federal government, from the Justice Department, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, not a fan of marijuana, legal or otherwise?
We haven't heard from him particularly, though we're certainly aware of his public statements. But, you know, Oakland started issuing cannabis permits in 2004 under the Bush administration, and the federal government raided and shut down Oakland permitted dispensaries under the Obama administration. And so, you know, we have been a leader in this. We've shown that our facilities are well run. They pay taxes. They pay their employees a living wage, and they've not become the magnets of crime that the opponents said they would. And so we have a long history of success through multiple presidential administrations in running this effectively. And it's important as it grows to make sure we run it both effectively and fairly so that people who've been harmed or been left out have a chance to participate.
So there is a kind of obvious law and order argument against this idea, and that is that these people who were convicted of a crime, they broke the law, they knew the rules when they broke the law, are now being rewarded for similar behavior. What is your response to that argument?
That this is part of what it means to stop the epidemic of mass incarceration in America is to acknowledge that Arnold Schwarzenegger smoked a joint on videotape that was publicly released and bragged about it, and after that got to be governor of California. Whereas it's been mostly poor people and black people who've been targeted for arrest and incarceration.
So the police are okay with this?
Well, you know, the police don't make the laws. They enforce the laws. And the Oakland Police Department will enforce the laws that are duly passed in the city of Oakland. Though I should also note that they have not particularly expressed having a problem with it. I mean, even if they did, it would still be the case that the law we passed is the law. But I think if you talk to most police when they're in an open, honest state and not standing in front of Jeff Sessions, they will acknowledge that marijuana is not particularly a dangerous or threatening substance, and that if you're serious about cracking down on violence, cracking down on gun crime and other serious things, that sending police to go after people for marijuana is certainly a waste of time, if nothing else.
Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
That's Rebecca Kaplan. She is a city council member in Oakland. Coming up, writer Teju Cole also takes photos. Most of them do not include people, only traces of them.
There's no such thing as unspoiled nature. In all my pictures, somebody has left something somewhere, or somebody has built something on a mountainside. And that's also interesting to me, too, because there's a blind spot, right? You don't see who put it there, but it's there.
How Teju Cole sees meaning in absence. We talk about his new book, Blind Spot, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Nigerian-American writer Teju Cole is known for his novels Open City and Every Day is for the Thief. He's also a photographer, and he's out with a new book of photos and essays called Blind Spot. You could call it a travel guide of sorts, but you won't see any typical tourist shots in this book, say the Taj Mahal or the Roman Colosseum. Instead, Rome, for example, is represented by four tables lined up in a park with white tablecloths on them. No people in sight. There are hundreds of images spanning from Lagos to Berlin to Brooklyn. And with those images are personal reflections on what the photos mean or illustrate for Teju Cole, their meaning or the meaning that is absent from the photos. And Teju Cole joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with the book's title, Blind Spot. You've written in the past that you actually lost your sight physically, lost sight in one eye, and have regained it. What happened and what caused you to lose your vision?
What it was startling. I mean, I woke up one morning and I simply could not see out of one eye. Mm. It was disconcerting because it wasn't easy to find out what had happened. And I ended up seeing a top specialist at a New York Eye and Ear who told me that blood vessels at the back of my eye, on my retina, had been exploding. And so there was a wash of blood over the retina. I mean, it sounds pretty gruesome.
It sounds awful.
Yeah, but when you're looking through an eye where that has happened, you're not seeing a field of red, you're seeing a field of gray. And the doctor told me that what I had was called big blind spot syndrome. I noticed that the way I was looking at the world did change, and my photography changed. But also, it was a real thing, but it was also kind of metaphorical because it helped me focus in on what had already been one of my big concerns as a writer and a photographer, which is the question of what are we missing when we look at the world, when we regard our environment?
What did you find that you were missing yourself?
That there are gaps everywhere, that within our system of knowledge, we like to pretend to a kind of totality or a kind of objectivity. We try to present an image of a place and say, this is what this place looks like. Or we write an essay about a subject and say, this is the authoritative view because I've done the research and I'm an expert. It just bound me a bit more closely to subjectivity. The fact that we never really completely know what's at stake, what's going on, what histories are embedded in the terrain we're engaging with. So, for example, I travel a lot and I go to various places for various reasons. Many of those places are delightful. They're beautiful places. I get put into nice hotels. I talk to nice people. But in each place I go to, I also remember that each human society is fundamentally formed by conflict. Conflict that then is later invisibilized in the self-presentation of the place. And very often, conflict that is not even over yet. So that for me to travel to a place is to somehow be reminded of the violence that has formed that place and somehow to be reminded that it is possible to still tell a story about the place that recalls that violence.
You have a lot of images from Switzerland, and I guess you go there a lot and you really like it. And Switzerland, of course, is famously neutral.
Yeah.
But how does it manifest its violence to you?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because we think of Switzerland as being a country that's very much at peace. It's a wealthy country. They've got beautiful nature that they take very good care of. And the cities are famously efficient to the extent that many people don't like it because they find it too smooth. In fact, I love it. I love being in a place where you can count on the train getting you where you're going in 15 minutes.
And the schedule I live
in New York, and I also grew up in a hot, flat, crowded African city, and I have no romantic notions about inefficiency. So anyway, I enjoy being in Switzerland. I enjoy being in disorganized places also. But Switzerland is a lot of fun to be in for me. However, Switzerland until the 19th century was actually quite a poor country. It was mostly farmers. The environment was quite harsh because of that mountainous terrain. And as comes with poverty, a lot of quite brutal things happened there. Like any other European country, for example, in medieval and even after Renaissance times, they were burning witches in Switzerland. It's also a country that made a lot of its money from mercenary warfare. And today it makes a lot of its money, of course, from banking, but also from very high-quality optical devices, contact lenses, from pharmaceuticals, from weapons. So those are some of the forms of embedded violence that sustained the neutrality and wealth of a place like Switzerland. I mean, I might be talking about Switzerland now, but actually no place is exempt. Each place has its myths about itself. The United States certainly has its own stories that it tells about itself. But to look at it closely and with a kind of intensity is to see a country that has essentially been formed by tremendously violent processes that are not over, of course.
Well, it's interesting that so many of your images don't have people in them, the agents of violence. Your images look so peaceful or static or at rest, I should say.
Yeah.
Images of landscapes or images of hotel rooms, drapes in hotel rooms, that there does seem to be a stillness to your photographs and a loneliness too. Are you lonely when you travel, when you travel so much?
No, not really. You know, I consider my work as a writer and as a photographer to be one of bearing witness. It just happens that the kind of witness I'm bearing is not a highly agitated form. It is actually trying to like witness history and record what I am encountering in some kind of tranquility. But I should also say that everything is fair game for your photography. So it could be a netting on a field, or it could be a cityscape as seen from a plane, or it could be a view of a mountain with a building in front of it, or it could be an interior with wallpaper and a couch. That you don't necessarily need the actual human presence for a picture to make sense. And in fact, if you put a person in the picture, then you're activating the picture in a way that you now had to give an account of. And so that even the most ordinary things can have a charge and an intensity to them.
Okay, well, let's talk about one of those photos. And this is a photo on page 42, Brooklyn. And it's a photo of a minivan, a car, a white minivan in Brooklyn. And it's parked behind a razor wire and underneath a sign that says cars. And it's also a white car in the sign. There's some echoing there. And in the accompanying essay, you write that for a long time you avoided having cars in your photographs, and then you realized cars are our shadow on the earth. And I know you're interested in the idea of shadows and how people shadow each other and how photography is kind of a shadow. And what do you mean by cars, though, as our shadows on Earth? How do they embody us?
In this particular text, I wanted to think about photography itself, because we have a car and we have a picture of a car above the car. A photograph used to be called a shadow in the 19th century. And that was interesting to me. So that a photo of something is its shadow. And in a way, the cars are our representatives. They are our shadow. When you look at a parking lot, almost each car represents each person. And in a funny kind of way, to be American is to be independent, have your own car from the time you're 16. That's not true of all of us. For example, I actually don't drive. But there's a way in which the car is our representative. And the classic American death is the car crash.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of elusive method I use in thinking about anything I look at in the terrain.
And so because you don't have a lot of people in your photographs, do the cars sometimes stand in for the people?
I think so. And I think that what is present in all my photos is the human touch, the human trace. There's no such thing as unspoiled nature. I'm very interested in the ways in which the world does no longer exists without us having touched it. In all my pictures, somebody has left something somewhere, or somebody has built something on a mountainside. And that's also interesting to me too, because there's a blind spot, right? You don't see who put it there, but it's there.
Yeah, I'm just flipping through your book and I notice that in all your pictures of nature, there is some kind of human trace to them. And even you do take a lot of pictures of nature that are pictures of nature in places like hotel rooms.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't want to make too many claims for originality because I'm a student of literature. I'm also a student of photography. And I don't think you should proceed with your work without being in conversation with the work that has been done in that field. our understanding of the world is already filtered through images. So that when I first went to Switzerland, for example, and I saw the great mountains of Switzerland, the first thing I thought of was all the images of mountains I had seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a while, I started to realize that not only was there easy access to actual mountains in Switzerland, but that everything I saw around me in Switzerland also had an image of a mountain on it. And then what then ended up happening was that when I actually went up into a mountain and took a picture of the mountain, it didn't look like a picture of a mountain. It looked as though I had taken a picture of a mountain.
Hmm.
And so the shimmering divide between what is real and what is a simulacrum of itself, that divide just sort of dissolved. And I think this is part of what creates the atmosphere of my pictures, that even their reality gets thrown into question. Was I really there, or am I just taking a picture of a picture?
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with the writer and photographer Teju Cole about his new book. It's called Blind Spot. There is a human being in your photo, and you photograph him twice. There's mm-hmm. the same picture is in your book twice, but developed differently. Mm-hmm. So the first time you see this boy, he's in Brazzaville in Republic of the Congo, and he's standing mm-hmm. near the Congo River, and you can't really see his face. And then in the mm-hmm. last photo of the book, you can see his face. And you write in the accompanying essay one line which really stood out to me: darkness is not empty, it is information at rest.
Yes.
Which I just love, because it made me just think about that for a long, long time. What are you trying mm-hmm. to say with that phrase?
So he is one of the sort of few people in the book. I mean, there are a number, there are a handful. Almost all the others are actually completely turned away from us. So we see a number of the backs of people's heads.
Mm-hmm.
And almost nowhere do we have somebody with their two eyes looking directly out at us until the last page, when this boy reappears. It's the exact same negative. Now, that's interesting to me, because when I was talking about subjectivity earlier, I also mean including your process in the work. The work is not some objective thing. The photo is not simply what emerges after I click the shutter. The photo is an unstable thing. When you take a negative, in fact, how you process it determines what you're seeing in the photo. And when I first processed this commercially, scanned it, his face came out very dark, and I wrote an essay about that. While I was preparing the book, I rescanned it in order to have a higher quality scan. And suddenly his eyes appeared to me.
Hmm.
And this line that you read back to me, darkness is not empty, it is information at rest, it's just a formulation of a thought I have been sort of wrestling with for many years. This idea that when you look at something, you should be aware that there might be something in it that you're not seeing. But of course, this idea of darkness, because in this case, for example, the boy is a black boy, he's dark-skinned. So the idea of darkness becomes not just a question of optical value, it becomes a question of skin color, it becomes a question of race, but it also becomes a question of history, what we consider to be a dark history, and all of those layers of meaning, all those possibilities embedded inside that word. I just wanted to sort of tease them out so that that final page becomes a restatement of what the book is trying to do as a whole.
Teju Cole, he's a photographer and writer. His new book is called Blind Spot. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you.
And if you want to see some of the photos we were talking about, you can go to curious.kcrw.com. We have a photo blog up now. Coming up, a photographer who specializes in portraits of people, people often overlooked. Carolina Miranda is here to talk about a couple of new photo exhibitions here in LA. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Carolina Miranda is here now. She writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. And we're going to talk about two photographers with exhibitions happening in LA right now. Both focus their lenses on working class life, one in present day Boyle Heights here in LA, the other in 1970s industrial England, one just establishing her career, the other looking back at his early work. Hi, Carolina.
Hello.
Let's talk about the current young artist in Boyle Heights. Her name is Star Montana. Tell us about her.
She is a young artist in her late 20s, I believe 29 years old, who is definitely, I mean, I hate to use the word rising star because her name is Star. Exactly, which is a great name, but has gotten a lot of attention for her photography and how honest and frank it is. She began, some of her early projects involved shooting intimate scenes of her family, her mother's death, her mother's passing in the hospital. These very sort of visceral experiences that we all live, but that aren't generally seen outside the home. And some of those early photos were shown at the Vincent Price Art Museum at East Los Angeles College last year. Now she has a new show at the Main Museum in downtown Los Angeles that is her portraits of Angelenos, primarily from Boyle Heights. There's also a few from South LA. And often these are people that she was born and raised in Boyle Heights. And these are people that she runs into, that she knows, that are friends of friends, that she sees on the street, that she has some kind of connection to. So this isn't a photographer parachuting into the neighborhood to take pictures. She's capturing the world around her.
And she also writes essays about them that accompany the photos.
Yes. With each photograph, there is a little narrative that goes alongside it in which she talks about the person's life, but also her connection to that person's life. If the portrait is this very stark, beautiful image of a person, the texts become a little bit more about Star Montana, the photographer. What is her connection to that person? What does she feel about their circumstances? And how do they connect to her own personal family circumstances, which over the course of her life hasn't always been easy.
So when you're looking at the photos, do you have an impression of who this person is? And then when you read the essay, you think, oh, I was right, I was wrong.
Yeah, the essays definitely, the little narratives provide, I think, another layer about the person, but I think more about Star, the photographer, and how she connects with that person and their story. So they really, sometimes a text can kill a photo because you just want to see the photo and be in it.
Yeah.
But I feel like what Star's texts do is illuminate her view and her connection to her subject, and they end up being as much about her as about the subject.
Right. Kind of like what Teju Cole was doing.
Yes.
But perhaps less intellectually removed.
Exactly. And more about personal. People and more about her connection to that person's circumstances.
Right. And also people, because he doesn't photograph a lot of people.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to Chris Killip. Tell us about him.
He is a photographer who became very well known in the 1980s in England, published a seminal book called In Flagrante. And what he did is he documented the deindustrialization in northern England in the 1970s and 80s. And so we're talking about mill towns, coal mining towns, shipbuilding towns. He went and he photographed the people, how they lived, how they worked, what they did for fun, a very sort of slice of life, street photography in the style of Henri Cartier-Bresson, who was very influential to him, sort of capturing the moment as it happens. He spent almost two decades doing that. And I think those are photos that are very resonant in the United States right now as we think about things like deindustrialization and poverty and worker retraining and all of the buzzwords that we have going on right now. He's offering us a look at a country that has been through this,
yeah,
and people that have been through this, and the people who have been on the receiving ends of the policies that the politicians make.
Any lessons learned looking at those photographs for our present era?
A couple of lessons. One, it's kind of amazing how hardy and how tough the human spirit is, no matter the circumstances, because he's photographing people in some pretty dire economic circumstances, but he's still managing to capture these moments of purpose and joy. And I think that's really important. And I think in my interview with him, what was really interesting is he talked about how in England, what he saw is what he's seeing here now is politicians not addressing deindustrialization honestly. That in order for this problem, for the future to be better, we need to be honest that certain industries just aren't going to make a comeback in the way that they once existed. That things such as steel and coal mining are you know, are ending. Let's look forward. Let's not resuscitate the past.
Did he ever go back and see how they're doing today?
He does. He actually goes back regularly and he stays in touch with he lives in the United States now, teaches at Harvard, so lives in Cambridge, and he goes back regularly and he stays in touch with some of the subjects in his photographs. So he spent 2 decades shooting there, so he knows these people really well. He says some of those towns have really changed. He has a series of photos called the Sea Coalers, where he would document people who would harvest coal that lay on a beach outside of a coal mining operation to make money. And that area, he says, has now, like, the coal mine no longer exists. It's been re-landscaped. He's like, it's kind of like looking at a golf course. You know, there's no sea coal. There's no sea coal. No sea coalers. Uh-huh. He's like, any evidence of that life no longer exists. So in a way, he feels that his photographs were really important at capturing this, this moment in time, this history that no longer exists.
And what similarities do you see or don't see between his photos and Starr's photos?
I think I see 2 similarities. Certainly 2 photographers capturing the working class experience and the sense of people struggling to hold on onto dreams, mm-hmm. during in somewhat dire economic and political circumstances. But beneath that, also a dignity that sort of no matter the hand you are dealt, that people do everything they can to maintain their dignity in the circumstances that they have.
And his pictures are where?
His pictures are currently on view at the Getty Museum in Brentwood. There's a whole collection of his 1970s and 80s images, as well as ephemera, some of his negatives and contact sheets. And you can see how his entire process as a photographer works. He worked entirely in black and white. And it's interesting to see that some of the pictures that have become so iconic of his work, oftentimes he would just take a single frame or 2 frames, and then that was it. This is in the days of shooting film. He shot it with a large scale camera, so he couldn't just go and shoot a million pictures. So it's amazing to see his economy, his precision, and his connection to the people in the images.
I didn't ask you, does she shoot on film or digital?
Star shoots in color digitally, I believe, and she prints her images at a large scale. And so when you walk into the main museum and you see them, you really feel like you're surrounded by the presence of these people, because they're almost on a human scale. I mean, it's something like 32 or 36 inches tall. You are looking at these individuals.
It's kind of like a Richard Avedon shot.
Yes. You are looking at these people in the face. And there is something really magnificent and immersive about that experience.
Okay. Well, thanks for both of those tips. Those both sound great.
Yeah, great photography week here in Los Angeles.
Exactly. Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the Los Angeles Times, and she is a regular contributor here at Press Play. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, by the way, you can see some of those pictures. Hold on with that theme song. You can see those pictures on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Okay, hit it. There you are.
There I am.
Whew.
I popped up.
For just a sec.
Our president dropped another Twitter bomb this morning.
Speaking of popping up.
Yes, indeed.
Or popping off.
The United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. We asked our listeners their thoughts on this. Trisha Holcomb says, I think it's the right thing to do. I would not want a man in the service with me that thinks he's a woman and be in the barracks or shower with me. Zap Rousdower liked that response, but they were kind of on their own. Most of the other responses were pretty negative to the president's decision. Raymond Rohde said, I don't have a problem with transgender serving, but I do have a problem with the military being expected to pay for the required surgery. Sherry Brooks Vinton said, we need to stop holding straight, white, and male as the ideal to which everyone else is compared. The world is full of many different kinds of people, and eliminating any sector reduces not only our humanity, but our access to talented and educated individuals. There should only be one question: can you do the job? Metrolink Life says, I'm a vet, and I'm pissed. The president is attacking service members for nothing other than political points. And there are a number of people that pointed out that this is politics. Melissa says, let's talk about healthcare. Please, don't get distracted. Whoops. Sorry, Melissa. Follow the bright, shiny thing.
I think we were definitely distracted. All right. Thank you so much, Christian Bordahl. And thanks for listening. You can weigh in on whatever you want on our Twitter page or Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.